Welcome to episode 22 of our podcast series. This episode features material from our November 2024 print edition of the Residential Aged Care Communique. I'm Professor Joseph Ibrahim, the editor. The podcast presents two cases highlighting the challenges of facilitating and supervising community access for residential clients. Our expert commentary addresses the influence of the system's design on tragic failures of governance and care. Mr. Anthony Black, who leads the enterprise risk management practices and frameworks for a major insurer of care services and community services, is the author of that work. Our narrator is Ashley Redmond, a practicing registered nurse and actor. Let's now listen to the editorial.
Editorial. Professor Joseph E. Ibrahim. This final edition of the Residential Aged Care Communique for 2024 is unusual. First, we present a double tragedy of the deaths of a 28-year-old casual support worker and a young child. The casual support worker died whilst employed to undertake respite care work. The worker attempted to save the young child in her care, who had exited a vehicle on a busy motorway. Both the worker and the child were struck by an oncoming vehicle, and both died at the scene. Second, we deviate from our standard case précis format to ensure clarity of the key issues and lessons learned. Third, we seek to encourage the aged care sector to draw on knowledge and experience from the disability sector, as there are many similarities in the philosophies, principles, and systems of care. Often, we get caught up in the apparent differences in the client demographics and settings at the point of care to see the similarities. In this case, some of the commonalities include the need for respite, a client who lacks decision-making capacity and may be impulsive, the need for social inclusion, limited workforce availability, a care worker working alone, and constant community environmental hazards. Other unusual aspects are evident in the second case, aspects of which we presented in episode 21, when we address the contemporary management of geriatric trauma. We revisit the case with new details, focusing on aspects relevant to respecting a resident's choice and the need to have systems in place for harm minimization. Our expert commentary is written by Anthony Black, who leads the enterprise risk management practices and frameworks for ANSVAR. Anthony started his career as a nurse before entering health services management, and then being a senior risk advisor in the health, education, and community health areas within the Victorian state government. He is uniquely qualified to comment on risk management in the aged care and disability sectors. We close out the year by expressing our sincere thanks to all the expert commentators, case précis authors, faculty of nurse experts, and the Communique's Australia production team. We look forward to continuing to serve our readers in the collective effort to improve the quality of care and safety for older people, the aged care workforce, and the community with the lessons learned from the coronial cases in the new year. Next year will be the 20th year of production of the Residential Aged Care Communique.
Let's now listen to a description of our first case report titled Always Ready to Help.
Case 1. Always Ready to Help. Case précis author, Dr. Chelsea Baird. Clinical summary. RS was an 8-year-old child who was diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder and global developmental delay around 4 years of age. RS had limited speech and communication skills. From the age of 6 years, RS had been living full-time with a foster carer. The foster care program was under the oversight of the Department of Communities and Justice. RS had high care needs, requiring constant attention and supervision. It was also observed that RS was well cared for by his foster carer, who was responsive to his needs, and that RS had a strong relationship with her. However, case managers were aware of the urgent need for respite care as the foster carer was receiving no respite at all, and she was increasingly expressing the need for additional support. Respite care arrangements. Department of Communities and Justice staff approached an independent respite care organisation requesting urgent weekend respite for RS. Specific information regarding RS's behaviours and needs was not provided, despite the presence of known assessments that RS required two carers, and an existing behavioural support plan was also not provided. The respite agency provided a quote for weekend care and indicated that they would have the capacity to provide weekend respite within 2 weeks. The quote for the service provision was made without knowing RS's current needs, including the level of support he required generally and the specific support he required for transport. The respite agency requested that the Department of Communities and Justice complete formal referral documents. As the proposed respite date approached, the referral still needed to be completed because senior authorisation was required. On Friday, the day the respite care commenced, the respite agency was still awaiting confirmation of the respite plan. The paperwork to authorise respite arrangements was escalated within the organisation at 3:27 p.m. This document stated that the department would provide information regarding RS's recent behaviours, needs, and medication dosage. Such information was never provided to the respite agency. Approval was forthcoming at 5:34 p.m. RS was collected from his foster care home at 5:45 p.m. When RS was collected, the respite worker who transported him had a conversation with his foster carer. It was explained that RS could undo a normal seatbelt and that an extra clip was necessary. The care worker noted that nothing in the original request suggested that two workers were necessary. The coroner opined that the respite agency should have been more proactive in demanding completed documentation and that the organisation of respite care was extremely rushed, with no proper assessment of RS's needs. The respite agency's philosophy was always being able to assist quickly. The agency also indicated that it was familiar with RS's care needs, having provided respite support 3 years earlier. Weekend care. Respite care occurred at a respite house over the weekend. Once transported, a verbal handover occurred, providing information gathered from the transporting care worker, who personally knew RS, and his foster carer. This information was written down for all workers to read when arriving at the house and before beginning their shift. RS's car seat was transferred from the care worker's vehicle to the agency's Toyota Tarago, and the child locks were activated. It was also verbally handed over to staff that RS liked to run away from his worker and thought this to be a fun game. Over the course of the weekend, respite care continued without incident. Two of the weekend care workers had never worked for the respite agency or attended the respite house previously. They relied on verbal handover and written notes to communicate information regarding RS's needs. RS was provided with one-on-one care at all times. Despite the pre-existing assessment from the Department of Communities and Justice that RS always required two people for respite, Miss RM was a 28-year-old casual support care worker who came onto her shift on Saturday evening at 6 p.m. She was instructed to contact management if she had to transport RS, but was provided with no additional details about transportation needs. On Sunday afternoon, the respite agency's operations manager received a text from Miss RM stating that there may be some delays with dropping off RS as he didn't want to put his seatbelt on. Later, the operations manager noticed a missed call from Miss RM, but found the phone busy when she attempted to return the call over the next 15 minutes. She rang Miss RM again, who was now driving when she took the call, and indicated no concerns. It was later ascertained that Miss RM had contacted another care worker who knew RS, and they had provided recommendations to assist RS in putting his seatbelt on. The young child, RS, exited the vehicle. RM was driving on a busy motorway. Both she and the child were struck by an oncoming vehicle, and both died at the scene. The coroner was critical of both the respite agency and the Department of Communities and Justice. The department's failure to pass on information was a most significant error. The respite agency failed as an organisation to provide sufficient information to allow appropriate assessments to be done, and, accordingly, failed to safeguard the safety of its workers. Workers were not adequately briefed on the risks involved with caring for RS, particularly the risks involved in driving with him. The coroner also found that RS should have been provided with two carers at all times when he was transported during the respite care period. Fatigue and scheduling of staff. Staff fatigue and working hours were also examined at the inquest. Ms. RM worked alone as a one-on-one support for RS for the entirety of her shift. She had worked nearly 50 hours over 3 days and had worked continuously for 27.5 hours at the time of her death. 8 hours of that shift was designated as a sleepover shift, where the assumption is that the worker will receive a full 8 hours of uninterrupted sleep. However, on this occasion, each worker was directed to sleep in the same room as RS for safety reasons. The coroner found that this staffing arrangement was unacceptable and not consistent with industry standards. The respite agency is responsible for the safety and well-being of staff. An arrangement where the employee is working alone with a child with high needs for hours at a time risks the safety of the employee and the child. Level of training of staff. Whilst there was no evidence that the care provided by individual workers over the respite weekend was substandard, it was noted that staff lacked formal training. No minimum level of training is required for persons wishing to be employed with children and young people with disabilities who receive respite. Ms. RM had extensive experience and training, having obtained work health and safety training, first aid training, and a certificate 4 in community service youth. She had also received induction into the respite agency and additional training in care for persons with autism spectrum disorder, including how to predict and respond to certain behaviours. Other respite care staff working that weekend had not received additional training on responding to behaviours. It was remarked that the requirement for a mandated minimum level of training could adversely impact the recruitment of disability workers and, thus, the provision of services to the persons in need of support. The coroner recommended that training in assessing and responding to behaviours become part of the training provided by the respite agency, including cyclic refresher training programs.
Let's now listen to our second case report titled A Man Who Loved Walking.
Case 2. A Man Who Loved Walking. Case Precy author, Dr. Supriya Rama Krishnan. Podcast episode 21 of the Residential Aged Care Communique presented aspects of this case pertinent to the contemporary management of geriatric trauma. This Precy focuses on aspects relevant to respecting a resident's choice and the systems in place for harm minimization. Clinical summary. Mr. J.H. was a 92-year-old widower with a diagnosis of early-stage Alzheimer's disease, who was an avid bushwalker and, on entering an aged care facility, was assessed as at low risk of falling. Mr. J.H. had an unwitnessed fall in his room in late autumn and told staff that he felt dizzy after getting out of bed and fell to the floor, striking his head. He was alert and responsive, responding to verbal commands, and there was no change to his conscious state. 2 days later, the general practitioner noted a clinical deterioration and organised for Mr. J.H. to be transferred to an acute care hospital where he was diagnosed with an inoperable subdural hemorrhage. Mr. J.H. died the next day. Pathology. The cause of death was a subdural hemorrhage. Investigation. After Mr. J.H.'s death, his daughter discovered her father had walked alone to the nearby pharmacy that was about 450 metres from the residential aged care facility on the same day as the fall, causing the head injury. The evidence supporting this discovery was a receipt from the pharmacy for the purchase of a nail brush dated that same day. As more information was gathered, it turned out that Mr. J.H. was a regular customer. The aged care facility staff explained it had been determined that Mr. J.H. could make decisions about his healthcare needs independently, and the staff supported his choice to go for a walk to the pharmacy. However, the aged care facility did not have a record showing that Mr. JH had left that day. The coronial medical consultant reviewed the case details specifically about the daughter's concern that the walk to and from the pharmacy had contributed to Mr. JH's fall and subsequent death. Given the distance walked, Mr. JH's general low risk of falling, and the fact that the fall occurred later in the day, sometime after the walk, the medical consultant opined that the walk did not contribute to Mr. JH's fall. In addition, for Mr. JH's age and condition, it was thought that the walk was, in fact, good for him. Coroner's finding. The coroner stated that Mr. JH was allowed to attend the local pharmacy and accepted the medical consultant's opinion that the walk to and from the pharmacy did not contribute to the fall. Given these circumstances, the coroner did not make any recommendations or comments.
Let's now listen to our expert commentary titled "The Influence of the System's Design on Tragic Failures of Governance and Care."
Expert commentary. The Influence of the System's Design on Tragic Failures of Governance and Care, by Anthony Black, who is the General Manager, Enterprise Risk Solutions, Ansvar Insurance Australia. One of the most important undertakings by care organisations is to support people in living their best lives. In both cases, we observe a common and clear intention to provide services that reflect the best interests of the two individuals, supported by qualified care staff operating within large systems of governance and control. Yet these systems were unable to prevent their deaths. Tragically, system failures resulting in harm and death are not uncommon. What appears to be common, though, is an increasing reliance and sense of comfort on compliance as the means of risk control and mitigation. While compliance, the minimum standard to operate, is important, it does not provide a clear end-to-end picture of the systems, including the interactions between people, the organisation, and the environment, which is necessary to fully understand the complexity and risk in service delivery. When things do go wrong, the circumstances and individuals at the point of care often become the focus of attention and blame, and the fixes are made at this level. Meanwhile, compliance regimes are unlikely to be scrutinised for effectiveness, and frequently the context and systems in which the adverse event took place are not fully reviewed and continue unchanged. Doing nothing to continuously improve the design of a system increases the risks of failures and harm, particularly to vulnerable people. Every system is perfectly designed to get the result that it does. Dr. W. Edward Stemming. Both cases reveal failures within complex systems involving responsible care organisations, government regulatory bodies, and the wider health and social service environments. The cases also reveal limitations of coronial inquiries that, by their very nature, provide specific and sometimes slow and narrow findings. In my opinion, this is particularly relevant to the Mr. JH case study, whereby the findings appear not to address broader system factors, such as the adequacy of organisation governance. For example, whether board and management fulfilled their duty of care and whether risk management framework should have prevented or more rapidly responded to Mr. JH's circumstances. Another example of the inadequacy of some inquiries to address systems breakdown is evident in the circumstances of the death of an aged care resident from heatstroke. This was the subject of an investigation by the Aged Care Quality and Safety Commission and the Queensland Coroner. The resident was left unattended for 2 hours in the sun in February 2023. Both sets of findings note that the death was preventable and focus on the incident itself and make recommendations to strengthen localised elements of the care environment. From my review, nothing addressed the regulator or aged care department role. Little addressed the organisational systems of governance or the work environment, and the individual carer involved was terminated. Unfortunately, it seems even preventable deaths, particularly involving older people, do not carry enough weight to enforce a whole system review. Back to our two case studies, there are certainly critical issues directly at the point of care. Contributing factors such as fatigue, culture, cognitive bias, miscommunication between staff, complex behaviour management, individual risk-taking, staff training, and staff shortages all require attention. My challenge to readers is to step back and consider the wider contributing factors of the broader system relating to these case studies that contributed to the tragic outcomes. In doing so, consider the impact that you can have in influencing the improvement and strengthening of factors within your system of operation. When reviewing the outcomes from care failures, we are often left with individual pieces in a jigsaw puzzle, rather than the view of the whole picture that the puzzle is meant to form. However, for effective governance in an organization, it is the role and duty of boards, managers, and health professionals to piece together those puzzles to learn and then fortify the factors within its operating system that are critical to harm prevention. As a former nurse and senior healthcare leader, I understand that influencing change and understanding system issues can seem difficult. However, if we adopt a mentality that it is all too difficult, then we succumb to the system that gets the result it does. I work with care organisations around Australia to support and uplift in aspects that I believe will improve the systems in which they operate. With regards to the cases, this would include, but not limited to, 1. The board's full understanding of the context of care service delivery, including particular knowledge of the risks associated with care provided outside the walls of facilities. Work is often imagined to be undertaken in well-controlled environments. The tragic case of Miss RM and RS demonstrates that the care environment can, at times, for example, be a vehicle. 2. Adequacy of risk management frameworks that are often not checked for effectiveness or assessed for whether a positive risk culture is embedded. Over the last decade, royal commissions involving care services have consistently called out the inadequacy of risk management oversight. Yet many organisations continue to operate with a framework only suited for low, complex risks. 3. Dignity of risk. To ensure this is backed by governance and tailored education so that the culture truly supports the right to autonomy and choice while executing a duty of care and being clear on what the duty entails. 4. Incident review processes and challenging organisations to invest in a just culture and systems approach to incident investigation to improve recommendations to address vulnerabilities within the system. 5. Organisational development is often confused with training. Findings in both cases place a high reliance on training to change circumstances. Training is a weak recommendation unless it is strengthened by the organisation with mentoring, support, and time and resources to do the job. Editor's note. Dr. W. Edwards Deming was an eminent scholar and teacher in American academia, covering a wide range of interrelated subjects. From statistical variance to systems and systems thinking to human psychology. Considered by many to be the master of continual improvement of quality, Deming is best known for his pioneering work in post-World War II Japan. See website https://deming.org/deming-the-man/.
Let's now listen to the reflections of senior nurses.
Reflections from senior nurses. Our nursing faculty contributors include Amanda Watson, Risk Management Coordinator, Victoria. Lily Gawley, Transitional Nurse Practitioner, New South Wales. And Catherine McGovern, Manager, Governance Strategy and Clinical Development, South Australia. Comments about Case 1. Always ready to help. Work schedules. Staff fatigue contributed to this tragic outcome. Fatigue is a result of working continuously for over 24 hours and working in excess of a usual week's hours in 3 days. The coroner noted, and it is worth reinforcing, that just because staff agree to more shifts This acceptance alone doesn't make it safe. The motivation to work the extra shifts is understandable, to ensure good care for residents. However, it is a double-edged sword, as fatigue may contribute to unsafe decision-making and suboptimal work practices and negatively impact staff health. Communication and effective handover. Case 1 highlights the importance of a comprehensive handover when care arrangements are transferred and the need for staff to understand their responsibility when some or all aspects of care are temporarily given to another agency or person. In addition to the coroner's recommendation of training in assessing and responding to clients' behaviours, staff should be provided with the knowledge, skills, principles, and strategies needed to support effective handover. Simple solutions, such as the SBAR communication tool, provide a way to standardise the content of handover delivery and ensure those involved are aware of clients who have significant levels of care or present occupational safety issues. The communication tool is a framework with four parts describing the clinical, situation, background, assessment, and recommendation. Assumptions. This case highlights the dangers of making assumptions. If a provider or staff member views being familiar with a client's care needs based on previous experience with their provision of care, the underlying assumption is that the client's needs have not changed. Care providers and staff ought to make all necessary efforts to gain up-to-date information and assessments about a client's current needs to avoid misunderstandings or having gaps in what is required for managing short-term care arrangements. Prior to accepting a referral for respite care, providers should undertake a risk assessment to determine if they have the necessary resources, including staff, to support care requirements. Respite care. Implementing a respite systems checklist is a useful tool to identify if the facility, or in this case, the agency, has the capacity to provide the required care and support available to meet care requirements, particularly if there are identified specialized care needs. This may include identifying if the required pre-respite information has been adequately completed or if further follow-up is required from the agency or applicant. Identifying any known documented risks that require strategies to maintain safety for the client and there is the capacity of the service to manage the risk. Checking if workers are appropriately skilled, trained, and equipped to deliver care and services to the client. Workers have the appropriate qualifications, checks, and clearances to deliver services. Clinical staff have recency of practice in any identified specialized care needs. Identify any worker safety issues and whether these can be met. For example, by supporting isolated workers, providing personal protective equipment, or installing a duress alarm. Comments about case 2. A man who loved walking. Trigger for review. Given that Mr. J.H. was previously assessed as having a low risk of falling when he experienced dizziness prior to the first fall, this should have been a trigger that there was a potential underlying medical issue. Ideally, the registered nurse would have notified the general practitioner and requested a review. Clinical pathway. A clinical pathway describing the steps staff should take with a resident post-fall is good practice. A pathway provides clarity for staff and a consistent approach and should address how to manage witnessed and unwitnessed falls and falls with or without a head injury. Additionally, registered nurses should identify other clinical assessments that may be needed post-fall, including pain assessment, repeat fall risk assessment tool, environmental assessment, mobility assessment, and referral to allied health professionals. Dignity of risk. The story of Mr. J.H. is, in part, the story of a man who loved walking. As an avid bushwalker, it seemed he continued his enjoyment of walking after being admitted to the residential aged care. He regularly walked to the pharmacy near his residential aged care facility. In reading his story, I wondered how the aged care home supported his passion for walking. A documented dignity and choice risk assessment with clear strategies to maintain Mr. JH's safety whilst respecting his choices and preferences may have included informing the aged care facility staff when he leaves the facility to go for a walk and likewise notify staff when he returns. Providing an estimated time of return to the facility so that staff could take action if he did not return within the agreed upon time frame. Taking a certain pre-designated route to a specific destination. Having his emergency contact details and the name of the aged care provider. Carrying his mobile phone. Wearing certain shoes and taking mobility aids as recommended by Allied Health. In consultation with the resident, establishing a shared understanding is essential, and it also must be communicated in a way that is clear, easy to understand. The plan should enable the resident and family to understand benefits and possible harm when they make decisions about taking risks in day-to-day life and over the long term. 2024 National Mental Health Webinar Series. This highly successful webinar series highlighted managing complex and major mental health conditions in Australia's residential aged care services. The webinar episodes are Episode 1, Accessing Mental Health Services for Older People. Who should I call for help? Keynote speaker, Dr. Terry Chong, psychiatrist and clinician researcher, Department of Psychiatry at the University of Melbourne. Episode 2, Wellness and Social Inclusion. Keynote speaker, Professor Deirdre Fenshaw, Director of the Australian Centre for Evidence-Based Aged Care, La Trobe University. Episode 3, Depression Recognition and Management. Keynote speaker, Sentia Professor Henry Brodity, AO, Centre for Health Brain Ageing, University of New South Wales. Episode 4, Mental Health Presentations in Persons with Dementia. Keynote speaker, Associate Professor Stephen McFarlane, Head of Clinical Services, the Dementia Centre, Hammond Care. Episode 5, Mental Health Crises, Suicide and Other Emergencies. Keynote speaker, Professor Brian Draper, AM, Conjoint Professor, School of Psychiatry, University of New South Wales. We also thank our partners in this collaboration, who included Uniting Age Well, the Australian Centre for Evidence-Based Aged Care, La Trobe University, Bi-National Faculty of Psychiatry of Old Age, the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Melbourne, School of Psychiatry, University New South Wales, Centre for Healthy Brain Ageing, University of New South Wales, Dementia Support Australia, Australian Association of Gerontology, Occupational Therapy Australia, Australian Disease Management Association, and the Residential Aged Care Communique.
Thank you for listening to this podcast episode. Remember, the online print versions are available at our website. This also includes a list of the recommended resources and references. Remember, we now have an extensive podcast catalogue of previous editions for the Residential Aged Care Communique, along with our sister publications, the Clinical Communique and Future Leaders Communique. We also have a library of recorded webinars that examine clinical dilemmas and mental health. I'm Joseph Ibrahim. Thanks for listening.